affidavit a little bit. Okay, so understanding private sector investigation. We talked about private versus public, right? You guys remember the difference? What you said? What's going on? You all right?
Yeah.
Cool. You here for real estate? No, I'm just. what was the difference between public versus private? Definitely. Public, government, criminal cases, private, more so company, businesses dealing with their kind of legal issues in that sense. All right. So understanding private sector investigations, they involve private companies, lawyers, address company violations. And the thing to understand is that companies like necessarily don't want to have to go to court with these issues. They want to just be able to resolve them without having to do all that that process. All right, so that's not like their initial goal and their intent, but they're not going to, I mean, they'll do it if they have to, though. But that's not what they want to do because it costs them money, them time, trying to do all that. So businesses strive to minimize or eliminate litigations from being involved, like, say, in court cases. But private sector crimes can involve email harassment, falsification of data, gender and age discrimination, embezzlement, sabotage, and industrial espionage. So those are kind of some of the common ones that we see. And so it talks about, one of the things here is like the line of authority, which basically says like who in the company has the right to start an investigation or to start a case. So it's not just like anybody, like somebody you're working with can just see you doing something and then start an investigation on you. Like, it has to come from a person of authority who has that authority to be able to do that, all right? So that's what it's talking about when it talks about the line of authority. And just the policies and rules. We kind of talked about that a little bit when I was talking about, like, contracts and actually reading those and has the information in there. It's interesting. I just actually, because I guess I can tell you that now. I might miss class on Thursday, next Thursday. I'll let you guys know for sure. Was that a cheer?
Something with those ceilings.
Oh, okay. I have to go to a funeral out of town, and so I know I'm gonna miss Wednesday for sure. But I was just like looking at my contract to see how it works as far as missing days, because I never miss days. I'm always here, and so just looking at it, like I see, like I have time and I'm able to take Thursday off. So if I'm able to change my flight, because I already booked it to come back on Wednesday, but if I can change it, then I'll probably do that and just not show up here. I didn't know that until I like, looked at the contract and like had to look at that section to know like how my time works. I just found out like my off days kind of like roll over. So the ones that I don't use, they continue to carry over. So I have like probably like a month of vacation. Take it all at once? Don't? Oh, okay. So, yeah, just like I say, just knowing what you can do, knowing the policies, knowing the things that are in place. Big part of, you know, a lot of company investigations, they have the acceptable use policy, just to know what you can and what you can't do. You guys know kind of what you can and can't do here? Like as far as, let's say, using the computers. You guys know like what's acceptable and what's not.
As a matter of fact, no, we don't, because there was not a banner on the computer when I started using it. They didn't make me accept the user policy.
Got you.
So there is no policy, as you can do pretty much whatever you want to do.
Are you sure?
I don't know. When you have to sign in to like the Wi-Fi and then
I don't sign up to their Wi-Fi. I never use their Wi-Fi.
But when you register for classes, you also have to accept terms and use.
Yeah, and there's a code of conduct that you sign on.
Code of conduct, I know I accepted that, but that didn't have anything to do with electronic devices.
Did you read it?
That does. Ethical.
Yeah, I've read in the bold print.
So there are certain things you guys can and can't do. Like I say, actually, you guys did agree to, I believe we have something that you have to actually agree to in order to, like, say, sign in. But most people just click I agree anyway and just go. Those are things you want to know. Definitely want to know that. And so, kind of talking about, like, the warning banner, right? So the warning banner tells you, like, it can tell you that you're being monitored, that, you know, the company is, you know, watching what you do and that they have the right to be able to do this. And you're agreeing to that once you click OK on that banner. And this is kind of what one could look like. So this is like a U.S. government facility. You are about to access the United States government computer network that is intended for authorized users only. You should have no expectation of privacy in your use of this network. Sounds crazy, right? And then use of this network constitutes consent to monitoring, retrieval, and disclosure of any information stored within the network for any purpose, including criminal prosecution. So that's an example of a warning banner that you just understand and agree to that once you click OK. That you're, anything you do is not private. It's all watched and open. So. Some sample text of, like, say, how you can kind of use those banners is just kind of listed there. You can look at that. That's basic and stuff there. So this slide here, three types of situations that are common in private sector investigation: abuse or misuse of computing assets, basically doing something you're not supposed to be doing on the computer. That's kind of the most common one. Email abuse, people sending things that they shouldn't be sending. And then internet abuse, people on sites doing things that they shouldn't be doing. So these are kind of like the common criminal investigations that happen, that occur in the private sector. This is usually, if it goes to court, it's for typically one of these reasons. Somebody's doing something they're not supposed to be doing. The private sector's job is to, you know, they're trying to minimize this risk. They don't want this to happen, so they try to, you know, tell you as much up front as possible so that you don't fall into this, so that this doesn't happen to you. But then it can get kind of tricky, right? Because now a lot of companies, a lot of jobs do the bring your own device, right? So, like, now I'm bringing my own device, so does it still fall under the company's rules?
So if you get on the school's Wi-Fi, mm-hmm. It's part of that.
So if you connect to the network, then that means you're under and agreeing to the rules that have been set up, right? Okay. So that's like something that, you know, people are fighting. People are, you know, because people are on their cell phones doing things, right? That probably they're not supposed to be doing. But they feel like, you know, well, because it's my phone, like, I should, you know, what I'm doing should be okay, and it should be private because it's my phone, which is my private phone. But you're not on your private network, so it's not so private, right? It, you know, falls under the school's rules and the things that they do, right? So that's just something that, you know, is a kind of an issue that people try to bring up and try to fight against. But typically, it usually falls under those same rules, right? I don't know if you guys had parents, but like parents that were like mine, kind of strict. I know you guys had parents, but parents like mine were kind of strict. Where it was, you know, whenever something happened or like you know you didn't like something, like, you guys know what they would tell you? So kind of like my way or the highway. Like, if you're living under this roof, then you're gonna follow my rules. And so that was just kind of like, you know, my mom and dad, like, if you didn't like something, like, move out, you know. But if you're here, then you're going to follow these rules. And that's in a sense like, you know, if we bring electronics and they connect to the network, then we're going to follow and obey kind of those rules. It doesn't matter, you know, what device it is, it falls under that category. Talks about professional conduct, all right? And that's just the way that, you know, we carry ourselves, the way that we, you know, talk, our reputation. A good reputation means a lot, especially in court. right? Because in court, the first thing that they do is when you try to testify, you guys know what it is? They discredit you. They try to attack you as a person. Because if they can attack you as a person, then nobody wants to hear what you have to say, right? If you're known as a bad person, Connor, like if you did some bad things, and that's what I can bring out and get everyone to think about, then nobody wants to hear what you have to say. Whether it's true or not, if I can make people look at you, then I win. Because they're not listening to you. They're thinking about you and the things that you've done. So that's why, your name, your reputation, it means a lot. And not only, digital forensics and things like that, just in life in general, like having a good name, it means a lot. Having a good reputation, it means a lot. People will know you without really knowing you just based off of someone else saying good things about you. There's been times when, like, I've been around here and just kind of meet people and they're like, oh, hey, you're that one instructor. You teach, this and that. And I'm like, yeah. Like, but I never met that person, but somebody else was kind of talking and then they ended up, like, kind of mentioning me. But it just, I'd rather have that reputation than the reputation of, the one teacher who, but the one teacher who, got in trouble for, stealing or something like that, anything bad. But a good reputation, it follows you. It follows you wherever you go. If you're looked at as a bad person at school, like, you're going to run into other people outside of school, and then that same reputation is going to be there, right? So it's nice to have a good reputation, to have a good name. So that when they do try and discredit you to make you seem like a bad person, Norman, to make it seem like when you stole from the candy store when you were like 10 years old, like that has no effect because what you did at 10 and looking at, the rest of your life, like you're a different person. We see that you change, right? I was watching O.J. versus the People. That's what I was watching. O.J. trial. And just kind of like hearing them talk about like their strategies for the different people they were calling on stand. That was the first thing that they talked about, like was the person, their history, their background. And if they can get people, like I say, focusing on their background, focusing on their history, their past arrests and cases that they were involved in, then they wasn't listening to what they had to say now because this guy is known as a liar, right? Why would I listen to him now? If he has a known reputation to lie, why would I listen now? If this guy has a known reputation for setting up cases and not doing things the way he should be, why would he do it right now? Right? So it's just a matter of, like I say, having a good reputation, a good name. So because it's going to follow you, it's going to make you more credible when you're testifying, giving your expert testimony. Right. Okay. And so we talked about kind of collecting evidence. We want to make sure we do that the right way because there's a certain standard that needs to be met with that. And then we talked about chain of custody for a little bit. And so the technical definition of chain of custody is the route the evidence takes from the time you find it until the case is closed or goes to court. So between the time of you finding it and the time it goes within court, there's a trace of it. There's actions, there's documents of where the evidence is, who had it at all times. At no time in between that point should the evidence not be accounted for, should it not be able to be found. There's always a track and a trace of the evidence. Have you guys ever seen the show? I know you guys don't watch a lot of TV like I do, but I just figured I'd ask. What was it called? Reasonable Doubt. No? Okay. So Reasonable Doubt, it's a show on ID Channel. That's a show I'll be watching a lot with all like the criminal shows and stuff. But it's a show where they have this investigator working with like an attorney. And they're working together and they're looking at cases like usually brought by a family member. So let's say Norman was in jail. Just an example, Norman. You're good. You're out. You're good. All right, so let's say Norman was in jail and I was Norman's son, right? So I would go contact them to basically kind of look at the case, open, not open it up, but look at it to see if he's actually guilty or not. And so the people, they work together and they're looking at the case, they're interviewing people, talking to people. But it was one case I saw where it was this guy, his son was in jail, and his dad, you know, saying he didn't do it, and that, you know, all these things went wrong with the case. But one of the things that went wrong with the case was that they lost 40 items of evidence. They lost 40 items of evidence. Like, how do you lose 40 items of evidence? I mean, he's still in jail, but it's just like, that was one of the things that they brought up. Like, they had all this other evidence that might have helped his case, but they can't find it. They lost it. So that evidence is not able to be used. And so I know it sounds like, you know, a lot and like, how does that happen? But things like that happen. How? I don't know. It shouldn't happen, but things do happen. Right? So that chain of custody is important. We should always know and have documentation of every piece of evidence. Oh, okay. Let's see. Here we go. All right. Okay, so that's basically, you guys can get that, understand that. Company policy violations. We kind of talked about that. Surfing the internet, sending personal emails, things you shouldn't do. You guys know why companies don't want you using your personal email? Wasting their dime on your time. Okay. What's another reason?
It extends liability.
Say that one more time.
It extends liability.
What do you mean by that?
If you're under the company's jurisdiction and you do something like personal that is, you know, illegal or offends somebody or something, mm-hmm. then they can go and say, oh, well, he did that on your time, so it's your fault. He did it under your supervision.
Got you. Okay, cool. Why else? Why wouldn't they want you using your personal email?
Conflict of interest. You can take a company data, send it to your personal email account, and go for the stay within the company organization. And you send it to your email account, to your personal email account, and like now you're leaking it. Or you taking away data from the company that should be moved from within the data net or the company's network.
Definitely. Okay. Monica, you have your hand up?
I was going to say when interacting with customers or other employees, a personal email may not be secure, whereas a company may have a more secure type of email, especially if you're working in like the medical field and you have to keep it high or the legal field.
Definitely. So security. Oh, Scott.
I was just gonna add there's a lot of malware and viruses that travel through email. So like, perhaps if you like open up one of those or something, because you get a lot of that on personal emails.
Yeah.
Probably more versus than like a company email.
Mm-hmm.
But that could like damage their property.
Definitely. Definitely. And all the things you guys said, they're all correct. They're all reasons why companies don't want you using personal email. But some of the bigger ones are security and malware. Because no matter how good of a security system I put in place, all it takes is Callan to open up one email, and that negates everything that was done. I can have the best security system in the world, and all it takes is for him to... What are you interested in? Video games, right? So all it takes is for me to send Callan something, email attachment, talking about a video game. Like, check out this game.
Fishing
email. Right? And Callan, oh man, I love games, right? And now I'm in. The whole network, like, I have now have access just because he used his personal email. He checked it at work and now I would be into that network, into that system. Right? So that's kind of like the main reason, especially when you're dealing with sensitive data. Like I said, all it takes is one person. You typically hear this term like in security, like the weakest link in every security system is people. People are the weakest link. People you can manipulate, you can talk to, you can charm your way by people or get information from people. You guys ever hear the term like if you're going somewhere, you're trying to like, in a sense, do something you're not supposed to do or get somewhere you're not supposed to get to? Like they just say act like you belong. Like if you just go somewhere and act like you belong in there, like just walk past people, don't do anything, just act like you've been there, act like you belong. Like you'll be surprised how far you can actually get. Like because people, like they act obviously know what they're doing, obviously know where they're going, so I'm just gonna let them go, all right? And so that's like just people. People make assumptions. People think. People have feelings. People have emotions. Where you can talk to people. Computers don't have that. You're not gonna, sweet talk a computer or charm a computer. It's gonna do what it's supposed to do, which is why humans, people, are the weakest point in systems. So basically these next two slides, what they're talking about is an approach. And this is an approach to an investigation. With an investigation, we want to have basically kind of like an outline that we're going to follow. Like, so first we're going to do this. The first thing any investigator does is once they get an image or a copy is they make another copy because you don't want to work off the original. Whatever you get, you make a copy of it. And that's what you work off of. That's what you try to find data on. Typically, you make more than one copy. You make two or three just in case something happens. But basically that would be at the top of your list to make another copy of wherever the image is. From there, then you start to work and find other things that you're looking for, other things that, the investigation may entail, but you basically have a checklist that you're going by. So it's not just, going to this image and just look around everywhere, but you're trying to follow like a structure. Basically, you have some structure to what you're doing. All right, and that's kind of basically what it's talking about. You want to create a checklist, determine all the things you're going to need, and your approach just to the case. Like, how are you going to approach it? Because some cases you don't approach the same. There are certain cases where you know a little more information. There's other cases where you don't know as much. So your approach is different, right? If you know what type of file you're looking for, then your approach can be different. If you're just trying to find something, then that's a different approach, right? You have to be more systematic and kind of plan things out better, all right? And so, like I say, identify the risk, mitigate or minimize the risk, test the design, analyze, recover the digital evidence, investigate the data you recover, complete the case report, and then critique the case, all right? You guys know what it means when it says critique the case?
Go over one here.
Go over it, right? Like, in a sense, like you want to evaluate yourself, right? Evaluate how you did. I try to look at myself, like, after each semester. Huh?
You want to know about real estate?
Oh, no, a couple people just, like, not today, but, like, last week.
Okay.
Kept coming.
Okay.
So. But you're at 6:30. Okay, cool.
Gotcha.
That's
the teacher. I think I'm going to take his job. I don't know about houses. You want to critique the case. Critique, like, how you handled it. Critique what you did and how you did it. Maybe you figure out, you could have did it better if you did this. You could have did it better if you did that. Just kind of critique yourself. At the end of the semester, I always try to look at semester and see how I did, evaluate myself. And also ask you guys to kind of evaluate me in a sense, to get feedback from you guys about how I did, what you liked, what you didn't like, because I don't want to just have things like the way that I want to do it and nobody's learning from it or nobody's benefiting from it. So I want to hear from you guys to get your opinions, your feedback. So a lot of the things that I'm doing this semester are things that people told me last semester that they would have liked to saw in this class. Some of the things I'm not doing are some of the things that students said they didn't really benefit from. So I try to critique myself to get better, to make the class better as best as it can be. And that's what you want to do with your case. You want to look at it, look at your approach, look at how you did to evaluate yourself. And so basically kind of you're outlining the details of your case, your investigation, kind of the evidence you found, what type of evidence was it, where was the location of it. Because these are things like if you have like a detailed summary of it, in your next case, you can kind of refer back. Oh wait, the last person tried to hide something in this location. Let me look there again.
Would that be considered like an outline or like a general outline that you could have for just about any case when you come up? Could you make yourself a list of, you know,
procedures?
Yeah.
Couldn't you have a procedural list?
Definitely.
And you go in and you check off each box as you do it.
Definitely.
Okay?
Yeah, you can
do
definitely.
Do we have anything like that in our text anywhere that we could... coming up, we might be able to sneak forward and take a look at it and come back and be smarter than what we generally are.
I don't believe so. Maybe chapter 2, maybe, because it talks about like the lab report and the laboratory procedures. Mm-hmm. But I don't think it's like a real detailed outline. If it is, it's real general. It's real basic.
Because I know the book doesn't, it jumps around quite a little bit. I tried to ask it a question, mm-hmm. asked it to go search on the question. One of the questions that was at the end of chapter 1,
mm-hmm.
and find me this triad of computer security.
Yeah.
And it highlighted some of everything, but it never came up with the actual answer to the question.
Hmm.
The way that they wrote it. I mean, they had like four answers there.
Yeah.
And I searched on the triad of computer security.
Mm-hmm.
I did that search in the book.
Yeah.
And it came back with the, this, there, those, these, you know, triad here once, mm-hmm. and computer security down here. And, you know, by the time you read that whole section, you read the book again. Read
yeah.
the chapter again.
Yeah. Yeah, the book, it does jump around a little bit. And I think that's mainly due to having multiple writers. This book is not just written by one person. It's written by, I believe, three different writers. And they have, you know, joint thoughts and opinions on things. So maybe that's why it's not, like, as cohesive as maybe other books. It just has one writer who's writing everything.
But shouldn't it say, if you ask me a question, specifically, if you ask me a question, what is the triad of computer security? I should be able to search that in a PDF copy of a book and find all together those words, the triad of computer security, and then it should say, the triad of computer security is, boom.
Right. I get you. Unfortunately, I guess it's just...
The index would have that in it.
I understand that.
And I got a search engine working for me. I could have just looked at the index and found a triad.
He's like...
What time is it? It's 6.
They're early.
Oh my god.
They love their class.
They love it. They're really trying to buy a
house. I know. They're going to make me sit in here now, man. I'm just going to stay. All right. So, like this is, like I say, outline some things. You want to know what you're doing so that you can go back to it, look at it at other cases, refer back to it, so that you just have a better understanding of what you're doing. And it just talks about planning the investigation, which is, you know, I feel like that's, you can read through that and understand that. Talks about two types of evidence forms, single evidence versus multi-evidence. That's pretty straightforward, right? One is one piece of evidence, the other has multiple pieces of evidence. And then it gives you a sample of what it looks like. So this is multi-evidence. This is kind of like the sheet or the form that you would fill out for that. And then it also has the single evidence form. So generally they look, you know, kind of the same. One just has more lines and is able to incorporate more pieces of evidence. And so it talks about securing evidence. And like say, this is a big part. And this may not be solely on us. This may be more, you know, law enforcement, more police officers trying to secure the evidence before we actually get it to investigate anyway. But it's just good practice to know. Right? To use evidence bags to secure and catalog the evidence. So there are special bags used. Yeah, I've seen movies where they put, you know, the evidence in a bag, secure it, you know, label it, tag it, bag it and tag it, right? And so that's what you want to do. That's the protocol of what you want to do. You want to make sure everything is secure, everything is closed up, so that nothing falls out and you don't lose 40 pieces of evidence. Also, anti-static bags. So you guys know what those are? Okay, so bags that keep electronics from, you know, the static electricity that may build up in areas and from people, keep it from actually disrupting a hard drive or, you know, some type of storage device. So those anti-static bags will kind of help prevent that, right? You don't want to have, like, you know, the evidence basically you need to solve a case or solve a crime and it gets damaged from static. Like, that would be terrible. Like, somebody's, in a sense, like maybe their life is on the line, or maybe they already been in jail and you're trying to, you know, clear their name, but you don't have the evidence to do so because, you know, static. Like that would be terrible. Use evidence tape to seal all openings, dry bays, use well padded containers, basic stuff there. Also the environment, right? The environment that you have these electronics in matters, right? Things, moisture builds in places that can cause damage. So like things like that, we want to make sure we're not just like, you know, have no clue about. We want to make sure we understand like kind of the base. We want to make sure that things are secure. They're, you know, able to be transported and get to the place that they need to get to. We're good there. Okay, that's good. Internet abuse investigation. So it just talks about in order to conduct an investigation, organizations, the internet proxy server logs, which basically has a track of all the, you know, the IP addresses, all the logs that are connecting to it. Suspect computer IP address, suspect computer's disk drive, and then your preferred analysis tool. There's a lot of different tools out there. The standard tool that most investigators, most law enforcement use is FTK and NCASE. So those are kind of the two standard forensic tools. FTK, huh?
That sounds like a no.
Definitely. FTK and NCASE. And N is ENCASE. Those are two most commonly used forensic tools software.
FTK?
FTK, Forensic Toolkit, and NCASE. ENCASE. Like I said, there's others out there, but those two are pretty well known. They're popular. There's like certification for those two programs themselves that like a lot of law enforcement will ask you, like, are you FTK certified or NK certified? Like those are the two kind of staple programs. Like I said, there's others that, you know, other, you know, maybe companies may use, but as far as law enforcement, I believe as it's still FTK and NCASE. And I believe in a couple of our labs, we play with FTK, like a light version of it. It's not like a full extended version that, you know, if you buy it. But I think we play with a light version in a couple of our labs. So email the...
ENCASE?
ENCASE, yes, correct. So it talks about email abuse and email investigation, and there's a whole chapter that we're going to deal with on, you know, email and forensics and how to recover that. So we'll go through there. Skip the attorney, industrial espionage. Hope you guys won't do that. What do I want to get to? Okay, so here we are. We talked about it, interview versus interrogation. We talked about that last week, but just these are just the slides for it. So in an interview, they're usually conducted to collect information from a witness or suspect, right? They're trying to get information, basically. Interrogation, trying to get you to admit to something, trying to get you to admit that you did it or you didn't do it or you know somebody who did it. Two totally different environments. One's a little more relaxed and chill. The other one is pretty high intensity, especially if they're playing good cop, bad cop. Gets real high in there.
Conversations matter.
Definitely. That's just basically the difference between those two. What else in there? Yeah, that's just basic information. So it talks about like collecting evidence and how to avoid like damaging evidence, and it talks about using the right blocker. You guys know what a right blocker is?
Prevent you from writing to a hard drive while you're looking at it.
Prevent you from writing to a hard drive. So it allows you to be able to, you know, search things and look at things without changing the data. Because if you look at it, if you read it, then you change the date that it was last accessed, right? So having a write blocker basically prevents that from happening, right? Because if you're doing an investigation on a file and you don't have a write blocker and you open it up and access it, then you just change the date and now you can't use that in court because defense is going to say, well, at this date, this device wasn't in my client's hands. So this can't be his because he didn't have this device, right? So it just... You're going to lose information, lose evidence that you can actually use in the case just by not having a simple write blocker. So write blockers, there's hardware that you can use for that, and there's also software that you can use. And it's pretty much just a preference of what you're most comfortable with using.
Can you give us an example of a hardware type of write blocker? What is it?
Flash drives, put them in, start them up.
Mm-hmm. So that's
stick
typically.
Stick a memory card in there.
Yeah, so like I said, a lot of different ones you can use, but that's essentially what it looks like. You just connect that, and then that prevents you from basically writing over anything.
So you'll plug that into your computer and then plug the actual memory stick or whatever the hard drive into that.
Correct. Whatever you have the image on, if it's on a flash drive or if it's on like a SD card, like whatever you have it on, you'll just put that in there and then you're good to go. Or if it's a hard drive, you can also connect it in there also.
Looks like that one down at the bottom would be the most practical one. That one.
This one.
Well, it seems to me with its connections that it's going to be able to do multiple things. You can put a USB, it's just USB.
I think it's just like the other ones, is that they have a wire actually connected to this one, and it has a digital display. Much all the same.
So you see this one connected like to a hard drive. So like I said, they can, look at that hard drive, look at all the data that's there, and wouldn't write over anything that's there. So like I said, that's definitely something you don't want to, forget.
It's been my experience that imaging tools also, if you take an image of a drive, it would also tend to change stuff on the drive.
A bit-to-bit image? No. If it's just a straight image, it shouldn't change anything. You should be able to run the hash values from the initial image to the one that you've copied, and they should be the exact same.
Like a mirror image,
right? Correct. They should be the exact same. Unless maybe you compressed it and use like a lossy compression, because that changes because it's getting rid of like bits that are insignificant.
So then what it may be is the utilities that I currently use may not be built for this. There must be something special that they use.
So yeah, not every tool has like the write blocking software in there.
No, I'm not talking about write blocking, but I'm talking about, because I use imaging software every day. Okay, that's how, you know.
Okay.
Yeah. Hard drives, you know.
Yeah.
Failed hard drive, get the data off of it, put it on another one, boom, up and running.
Gotcha.
That's an everyday thing. But it seems to change the data just a little bit.
Okay. Do you run hashes on it to see?
No, I don't.
Okay. I would say try that.
If it boots, I'm a happy camper. Okay?
Okay.
Once I load that image on there, if it boots, I'm a happy camper. Yep.
Gotcha.
Do the updates and give it back to them.
Gotcha. I would say try one day. If you have time, you know what I mean, you're doing the image, to see if it's the same. Take the original image and run the hash to get that value. And then after you copy it, like run the hash again to see if they're the exact same. Yeah.
What are hashes? I'm not familiar with
that. Hash values, they're basically like a, they call it like a digital fingerprint, basically. So every file, every drive image like has basically its own value that can be generated. And basically, from that, actually, let me see if I can show you. I did the MP5.
Is this stuff we're going to be learning about in this class?
We're going to talk about it, yeah, definitely. And we'll deal with it definitely with forensics because it's that's a generator. I'm just trying to show you kind of some numbers of what it. So in a sense, right here, like this could be a hash value. So you take a file, you run the hash, and you would get like these sets of numbers. And then from that, like you want to check it to see if anything has changed. You just run it again. So it's like if I'm working on an image, right, and I'm, you know, doing my investigation, when I first get it, I want to take the hash value and see what number becomes generated. Then after I'm done working on it, after I'm done investigating and doing everything that I was doing, I run the hash again to see if it's the exact same. It should be the exact same. No number should be changed. Everything should be the exact same. And that means that nothing has changed. So that's what the defense does after an investigation is done. They check the image that was given to see if it matches what was initially taken. Because if anything is different, you're going to get a completely different number. And then they're going to argue that you changed data that was on that hard drive or that was on that image.
Now, are we going to get hands-on with some of this stuff?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, we'll deal with it in a couple of our labs.
So if the defense is arguing that you changed data because you accidentally did, is there some way to prove what you changed?
Is there a way to prove?
Yeah, by looking at the hash marks, I mean, it has to, something, right?
They're generated like, they're encrypted like, so you can't like reverse a hash to figure out like, you know, what it is or what it was. But like to kind of answer your question, technically, like, yeah, but in reality, no.
Because all they're going to say is reasonable doubt.
I mean, like, they're not going to try and figure out what you changed because they don't care. As long as they get a different hash number, that's all they're concerned with. But on your end, like, if you know maybe what you did, like, then that helps. I would say only if you made multiple copies of the image. So if you make multiple copies of it and you mess up on one, then that's fine because you know and understand what you did. So then you can just use another copy and make sure that it's still the same. Make sure that nothing changes. But you would have to kind of know that. That's not something that, you know, the hash value can tell you what was changed. But it can tell you that something did change, if that makes sense. Okay. But yeah, so we'll get more practice with hash. I believe there's... Like, you can do it on autopsy. You can run hash values to figure it out. From the image we were working on Tuesday, I believe we can do that. We might be able to kind of get into it today, maybe a little bit. And so another thing with the hash, but like I said, we'll get into it, but there's different strength of hash values also. So there's like MD5, SHA-1, SHA-128, 256, and it just basically gives you a longer number, longer code of hash values, which we'll get into. So let me see. Is there anything else in here? Investigation steps. So it talks about just basically how we're copying data. And it talks about a bitstream copy, which is bit by bit. So everything exactly like one bit at a time, like it's copying that and converting it to make another copy. And then you have the bitstream image, which is basically kind of the same thing, but it's put into a form of a image instead of, you know, bits. And it talks about the difference between backing up software versus like a regular bit-to-bit copy. Bit-to-bit is going to copy everything. All the fragments all there, all the deleted files that were there is going to copy all that information. A backup is only copying known files, things that are there. All right. So that's the difference between like making a backup versus actual bit copy of something. And we're going to deal with like recovering fragments and email messages and all that also. You guys understand how deleted files work?
I do.
Okay. So when you delete files, that doesn't mean that you're wiping them off your hard drive. What you're doing is you're telling your computer, or your computer is telling you, like, this space is available to be saved over. You can record data or overwrite the data that's there. But it doesn't go anywhere when you hit delete. It's still there. All right. So it just basically says that that space is available. All right. So nothing actually deletes when you delete it. It's still there. All right.
Even if you delete it from recycle bin too, it's still there.
Still there. Still there. Like I say, that space basically becomes available.
So how do you permanently delete files from a hard drive?
Like the Department of Defense? Like utility.
What's going on? Yeah, trying to buy a house?
Yes.
Nice, nice. Yeah, we're almost finished in here. We're doing security right now.
This, I'm way too old.
Yeah, a little early. No, I got you. I got you. No, you're good. You're good.
Good example of the day, man.
Come on in.
We got one.
Come on.
I didn't know.
We got
one.
I'm about to sit down.
All right. I know. So I talked to him, made him feel comfortable, and then he just.
It's been like, what,
4 or 5 hours? I know. All right, so, okay, so then, yeah, the last part just goes into basically kind of what we're going to do over in lab, and that's pretty much it. You guys can definitely read the rest of this. You just gotta write your. You gotta take your social security number and just.
No, just write your social security
number. Oh, y'all all
in here.
Alright. We'll head over to lab.
I think you should have made a bigger sign.
I feel like it like stanchions out. It's like blocking
maybe
off.
Put it a little higher, like where they face is.
A little higher.
I gotta look over the side.